When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hi, everybody. I'm Brian Norcross. This is our Fox Weather Tracking the Tropics podcast, number 3 of hurricane season 2022. Coming up on today's episode is the new acting director of the National Hurricane Center, Jamie Rome. As you probably know, former director Ken Graham moved on to be director of the whole National Weather Service, of which the Hurricane Center is a part. Jamie led the storm surge program for more than 10 years, and he oversaw a tremendous expansion of the science of predicting storm surge and how the public is informed. These days, you can't imagine not talking about storm surge when a hurricane is approaching the coast, but back in the day, it was a much lower profile threat. Jamie and his team have received all kinds of awards and accolades for the progress and the products they've developed over the last 10 years or so. We'll talk to Jamie about storm surge, of course, but also about what's new this hurricane season from the National Hurricane Center. Our conversation is coming up in just a moment. I'm recording this podcast on Tuesday, June 21st, 2022. As of today, the tropics remain quiet. It's a very different June than last year, when every little non-tropical disturbance near the southeastern U.S. seemed to find a pocket of conducive atmosphere for organizing into a tropical storm. But none of this says anything about the rest of the hurricane season. The factors that we look at in June are still, seem reasonably supportive of a busy season, unfortunately. The water along the equator in the Pacific, south of Hawaii, continues to be cool. Cold water there can make the atmosphere over the Atlantic extra conducive to hurricane development, and extra warm water makes it hostile. Water that's a bit cool, like this year, can be somewhat conducive to extra storm development, but it sometimes doesn't have much effect at all. The other big factor is the temperature of the water in the tropical Atlantic. It's been running just slightly above normal, but it's forecast to warm up some more. So this is why you're seeing forecasts that average about 8 hurricanes, which is above the long-term average of about 6. But it's not some like crazy number like 10 or 11 or 12 or something like that. The bottom line is, of course, we'll see, and we all have to be prepared. Okay, here's my conversation with the new acting director of the National Hurricane Center, Jamie Rome. Hi, Jamie. Thanks for coming on.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So congratulations on your new job, I guess. It's intense from what I can see from the outside. So what's it been like in the 2 weeks or so since you were appointed acting director of the Hurricane Center?
Well, I mean, fortunately, we had a little bit of notice, and so we had a transition plan already worked out. And so really the first week was about moving through that transition plan, making sure all of our staff and core partners and constituents were, you know, comfortable and understood the transition. And so now we're sort of falling into getting ready for what we call a hurricane season posture, meaning we're starting to make final touches to our communication system, our software, our tools, just to make sure they're hardened and ready to go. We'll run a few more stress tests just to make sure everything is up and ready for the peak of hurricane season. So now it's starting to feel a bit more familiar, I think, because This is more of a traditional cadence for us.
Is everybody back working in the Hurricane Center, or do some people still work from home?
Yeah, we're in a hybrid setup. And basically what that means is some at home and some in the office. Obviously, when it's a high profile or a very, very important forecast, like a hurricane or hurricane landfall, there's more in-person presence than at home. And then based off the CDC community spread levels and the level of activity from a weather perspective, we can also shift back home if necessary to keep our staff protected.
So as long as I've known you, you've been you know, focused on storm surge, and now you have to pay attention to everything. And is it hard to kind of look away from storm surge and you know, start looking at all of the other hazards, and not to mention just hazards, but all the communications and, you know, all the contacts you have to do?
It is a little bit. I mean, storm surge is the most recent long-term position I've had at Hurricane Center, but I was also a hurricane specialist for 2.5 years. And then I worked in our marine unit, tropical analysis forecast branch, for 6.5 years. And then sort of bounced around in various acting roles within the front office, which is where I'm at now. So I was acting executive officer for a while. I was acting deputy director for a while, then permanent deputy director for a little while, and now this job. So, you know, I can pull from it past experiences a little bit, and that's a huge help, I think. But to your point, storm surge is always going to hold a special place in my heart. I was there the longest, 12 years, and also because that was an upstart. You know, other parts of the hurricane program were more well established and remain well established, where storm surge was a relatively new endeavor. I think anybody who's ever started their own business will sympathize with this. You know, that's always, when you do an upstart, that's always going to hold a special place in your heart.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So let's start at the beginning, and then we'll talk about storm surge and everything else. How'd you get interested in hurricanes and end up at the Hurricane Center?
It was accidental. You know, I wish I had this great story to tell you of some past hurricane that you know, inspired me to pursue a career in hurricane. You know, I grew up in eastern North Carolina, which has its fair share of hurricane strikes. So, you know, I had hurricane experiences as a child, which contributed to my love of weather. But it was, you know, at the time, it was also winter weather as well. You know, I used to really like trying to distinguish the phenomenon that creates to rain versus snow. That type of weather. And then I went to North Carolina State University in Raleigh, North Carolina. You know, we had a couple of hurricane strikes and impacts there in the late 90s. And that just, you know, at some point I just found myself drifting more and more towards the tropical side of things. And there was an entry-level position at the Hurricane Center. And I thought, you know, what the heck? They're never going to hire me. Why not, you know, practice my application skills and that sort of stuff? And they literally called up one day and said, can you be here in 5 weeks? That's how it went. I was midstream my master's degree. So I ended up finishing my master's degree while here at the Hurricane Center.
Wow. All right. Well, so for many years, you said you were ensconced in storm surge. But when you got to the Hurricane Center, I mean, storm surge was a thing, right? It was kind of always a thing. I remember storm surge forecast for Hurricane Camille back in 1969. But what changed, and how did it become kind of a separate thing with the higher profile that it has today, deservedly, by the way? But it does feel different now than it used to before you started on this path.
Well, some of it's chance. You know, we had a long, as you know, a historian yourself, a long string of inactive seasons. And then the storms that did hit, like Andrew, were primarily wind, or at least, you know, that was the narrative. It was a wind-based storm from a damage perspective. And so that just caused storm surge to sort of drift out of focus in the late 90s and early 2000s. And we can really thank Bill Reed, the former director of the Hurricane Center, based off his experience in Houston, Galveston, and his vast knowledge of the potential storm surge threat there, who came to the Hurricane Center and brought with him this desire to put more focus on that phenomenon. And then we started having more wet storms, you know, more big storm surge events.
Not to mention Katrina, I guess, at some point.
There. Right. Right. So, you know, Katrina is obviously the you know, quintessential, you know, storm surge event.
And then followed by Ike 3 years later.
And Ike, I think, was the one that really broke the camel's back, at least for me. You know, to me, the storm surge forecast was really, really, really dire and severe. Yet you remember all those people had to be rescued off the Bolivar Peninsula.
Right.
And that's what got me thinking something's not right here. When the storm surge is this, when you're predicting 20, feet of storm surge and people don't evacuate, that's when you know you get a communication problem. It's not a forecast problem, it's a communication problem. And I think that's what really was the storm that pushed us all to focus on storm surge.
Yeah. Let's take a quick pause. We'll be right back on the Fox Weather Tracking the Tropics podcast in just a moment.
Jason in the House, the Jason Chaffetz Podcast. Dive deeper than the headlines and the party lines as I take on American life, politics, and entertainment. Subscribe now on foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you download podcasts.
So for many years, the amazing Brian Jarvinen was the storm surge guy at the Hurricane Center. And I remember learning about the SLOSH model that simulates storm surge from him. And it's really great to read even today his analyses of the great Miami hurricane of 1926, kind of retro engineering that one and Hurricane Andrew and other storms. Did you essentially inherit the technology of Brian's era, or had it significantly improved by the time you started focusing on surge?
You know, Brian, we can't say enough good things about Brian. I mean, so much of what he established, we still do today. And what many people don't know about Brian is he's a great trainer and mentor. And so he took me under his wing very early on, even long before I transitioned to the storm surge, and actually was one of the you know, senior staff here that taught me how to hurricane forecast before before I became a hurricane specialist. I can remember making forecasts of Charlie with him, which is, you know, really amazing. Ivan, I can remember a great story. Ivan remembers extremely low latitude, you know, at one point. I can remember he and I initializing it, Ivan, which means the starting point, you know, where it was located at the time. It was either 8.8 or 8.9.
Yeah, it was below 10 degrees. And we all said, well, no, I mean, they can't really do this below 10 degrees, can it? I mean, that was always back then sort of the cutoff. Since then, we've learned that that's not always the cutoff. Yeah, I remember 10 degrees was it. It had to be above 10 degrees.
So Brian and I were working that evening together. He was training me, and I actually did one of those forecasts. So he's just a great, great trainer, really believed in investing in the younger staff. So that legacy clearly lives on. But what he did with the creation of these moms and meows, which are just risk maps. That's all they are, is a risk-based map that then go into developing hurricane evacuation zones and, more importantly, hurricane evacuation plans. While the technology and the modeling has advanced over the years, that business model still to this day exists. Those SLOSH moms and meows are still the backbone of the nation's hurricane evacuation protocols and planning from Texas to Maine.
Yeah, they're sort of close to worst case in various different scenarios, but it can kind of tell you what's how bad could it be at any one location. So that's what they land for. I guess, you know, it's important, as we're going to talk about storm surge, to define these terms, because we have something of a conflict between the proper scientific definitions and the colloquial meanings, right, of storm surge, storm tide, and inundation. I mean, everybody always wants to know how high is the storm surge going to be, but they really want to know how bad the inundation is going to be. How bad is it going to flood? How do you sort all that out now that you've thought about this for so many years for people that don't understand the nuances of the definitions and the different words they might hear?
I mean, going back to how we started the conversation, this is a great example of why we were failing to communicate storm surge, because we as physical scientists are like just determined to use the most precise definitions and words. I mean, it's just so near and dear to our heart. Yet the outside world doesn't see things the way we see things as physical scientists. And so when we did focus groups, and back then, mind you, focus groups in government was controversial. Oh my gosh, you know,
this was the beginning of let's figure out what the people actually think we're saying.
And so that moment for me, you know, so we did these focus groups where you take ordinary non-scientists and you introduce them to terms like coastal flooding, storm surge, storm tide, you know, all these types of things. And the only phrase that people reacted to was storm surge. Now, they didn't fully understand it, but they understood that it was bad. Mm-hmm. You know, they had an emotional reaction when, you know, I could watch these focus groups and people would react like an emotional reaction, almost like a fear of the phrase. And that's when we decided, our job is communicating and protecting the public. So we need to use the terms that resonate most with them, even if as a physical scientist, we don't necessarily like those phrases or terms. And so storm surge, we started using storm surge for the collective whole, meaning any sort of flooding that arises from a tropical system pushing water towards land. You know, obviously that flooding is inclusive of tide. You know, storm surge, the pure definition of storm surge is the delta between the normal tide and what actually happens. So by changing the definition, if you will, to say storm surge is just inclusive of everything that's involved in coastal flooding, the physical scientists weren't happy, but the public, I think, was and reacted better to our products and services, meaning we call it a storm surge warning, not a storm tide warning, not an inundation warning, not a coastal flood warning. Right. That's a different phenomenon.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, the slogan of my life is precision is the enemy of accuracy. And nowhere does it better apply than in trying to communicate these things. So whatever the storm surge or the inundation level, there can often be and usually are waves on top of that, right? And they effectively make the water higher. Are they calculated in somehow and you know, when you make this kind of a statement, or is it really a separate thing?
That's a great question. So there's, if we're going to talk about waves, there's two things we have to sort of distinguish here. There's wave setup. So wave setup is the cumulative elevation of the water levels that occurs by many, many, many waves, hundreds of breaking waves over hours.
So the waves come in and the water doesn't completely go out because more waves come in and the push is generally in. So waves just kind of add up to this buildup of water, wave setup.
Right. As now, you said. We can calculate that, and that's included in our forecast. The modeling has advanced enough that we can include this sort of time-averaged wave impact. Now, what we can't yet calculate and forecast is what's called wave run-up. And that's when one wave, the instantaneous furthest extent that wave goes. So imagine a wave breaks and shoots up the beach or shoots down a road. That one wave, that's called wave run up. We cannot yet forecast that aspect of it. So our forecast is not inclusive of that.
But you kind of include some sense of how high the water can get that loosely include some of that, but we'll talk about those numbers in just a second. So when you started forecasting storm surge and being involved and thinking about how to make this better, was there a master plan? Could you envision all the additional graphics the storm surge unit would create and the challenges with language and everything else? Did you have any sense of where you were going, or was it really a one step at a time kind of thing?
No, we did. We kind of had obviously it evolves. It'd be unfair to say you sort of had it all planned out perfectly in the beginning. Yeah. But what we're up against in the beginning, so you got to take you back in time so you can understand conceptually. Mortality was thought to be rising, owing to Ed Rappaport's research on causes of mortality from storm surge, or at least we understood that storm surge was the leading cause of direct fatalities in tropical systems, and we wanted to try to find a way to bring that down. Well, the traditional way that you would bring down mortality would be to try to increase evacuations, right? Mm-hmm. And that's what we were wrestling against.
Evacuation is especially true in the post-Katrina, post-Ike era, as we talked about.
So the way to think about evacuation or evacuation area and mortality is like the Doppler dilemma, or false alarm ratio versus probability of detection. You can't pull on one without pulling the other, mm-hmm. right? It's just a tug of war. So what we were aiming to do, which at the time was thought to be somewhat reckless, was bring down storm surge mortality and shrink evacuation zones, or the size of evacuations in this country. Because the thought was, if you evacuate too large of an area, you basically render evacuations ineffective. Or what you do is you drive mortality up in just the evacuations. The example of that is Hurricane Rita, where 104 people were estimated to have lost their lives in just the evacuation alone.
Yeah, so, massive evacuations are dangerous things just intrinsically, and people are a little, you know, stressed and everything else. So you have a lot of factors going on right. that make that so.
So this was, I mean, this was our initial goal, was to shrink evacuation area with the amount of people evacuated and cut mortality. And again, that was back then was considered, somewhat controversial and difficult, because it sort of defied the conventional wisdom on how you would, you know, if you wanted to cut evacuation or evacuation area, it was assumed that you had to accept a higher mortality rate in so doing. So that was the initial vision. And then we built upon the ideas that started prior to me, advanced by Ed Rappaport, of an explicit storm surge warning. You know, historically, we've only had a hurricane warning, right. and we tried to communicate the storm surge threat indirectly with that hurricane warning. Where Ed had been advancing or advocating for years an explicit or separate storm surge warning, and we sort of built upon those early ideas and went from there.
Yeah, we should say that Ed Rappaport was the longtime deputy director of the Hurricane Center and wrote some of the great Hurricane Andrew forecasts.
Right.
As a matter of fact, he was the one that put in the discussion that Andrew might very well re-intensify just as it was approaching the coast, as it passed over the yeah. Gulf Stream, which caused me to not talk about it weakening over the Bahamas, because the idea of people thinking it was weakening and coming out of their safe place and so forth when you had the Gulf Stream ahead, that was a very prescient forecast by Ed. So I guess we should talk about, you know, how annoying storm surge is to forecast, because a slight wobble or bend in the storm track can make a huge difference on how high the seawater rises over land at any particular place, right? So since we can't forecast the storm's future track precisely, not to mention its strength and its size, it creates a communications challenge that feels daunting. So I can imagine when you really started to pull this apart, that was front and center of the thinking of what you're up against. Am I right?
Yeah, it was thinking back, sometimes I wonder if I had known what I know now, would I have done it? All the challenges that you highlighted, it's so location specific. Literally, you know, the storm moves 10 miles and you get a totally different outcome. Maybe even 10 or 15 feet difference, as we've proven in some of these past storms. But there's another element of it that made it particularly challenging. As we brought storm surge to the forefront and made it more, made the public more aware, they ascribed the same expectation of accuracy that we have for, say, the track mm-hmm. forecast. And the science and predictability of storm surge couldn't live up to that expectation. So as we put this big old spotlight on storm surge and these new products, the first few years were difficult because the public perception, you know, was at that time, these forecasts aren't accurate. You know, this is not going well. This evolution is not working well.
But that's because a little bit of track makes a lot of difference in storm surge, where a little bit of track difference doesn't make so much difference in the perception of how good the forecast was.
Correct.
Right.
So, and wind is wind. So if you take a Cat 3 hurricane based off wind speed, and you move it 10 miles, it's still Cat 3 winds. Mm-hmm. The wind doesn't vary with the track. You know, it is what it is. Whereas storm surge, you take that same storm and you move it, and you could have a totally different outcome, not only at that location, but just for the storm itself, the surge could go up or go down just on moving the storm around.
Yeah, just like because you have an opening, like the opening to Biscayne Bay in Miami. If the storm is north of there, the water is not being pushed in south of Key Biscayne. If it's south of there, it is being pushed in south of Key Biscayne. It makes a tremendous difference how much water you have in the southern end of Biscayne Bay, including downtown Miami, for example.
Yeah, exactly. Especially if this so-called radius of maximum winds, or what, you know, the eye wall. If the eye wall hits the opening of a bay just perfectly, you're going to get a totally different outcome than, say, if the eye wall or strongest onshore push of water is further north or further south.
Right. So when you put out a forecast like 4 to 6 feet from Ocean Springs, Mississippi to the Alabama-Florida border, which I think was a forecast during Hurricane Sally, maybe. Does that range reflect the uncertainty in the track, or the uncertainty in the timing and the tides, or is it more or less just a worst case? You know, this is what people should be prepared for, that kind of takes all that uncertainty into account.
So it's taking in all of the factors. It's taking in if the track moves. It's taking in the variations in tide. It's taking in the variations in local land topography and bathymetry. So it's taking in all of that. And I wouldn't say it's a worst case scenario in the traditional sense. But what to your point, how do you interpret this 4 to 6 feet from point A to point B? So a lot of people wrongly interpret that it's going to be 4 to 6 everywhere between point A and point B. And if we knew precisely where the hurricane was going to go, you know, 2 or 3 days beforehand, we could make that forecast. But because we don't, we have to, you know, bound it with these points. And that means that 4 to 6 feet is likely to occur somewhere between point A and B. So in essence, it is a risk. It is a form of risk communication, because it's not saying everywhere between point A and B will get 4 to 6 feet. It's saying someone between A and B will get four to six feet.
So what you're saying really is, if you knew where the storm was going, the technology today, the computer models, would tell you how high the storm surge is going to be, right? If you know the size of the storm, how fast it's moving, where it's going to hit, you know the bathymetry and or what the land looks like and so forth. So the storm surge technology is good. So back we were talking about in Brian Jarvinen's day, he used the Slosh model. I know this model called the Slosh model is really the basic model you use. But now we hear about all kinds of other storm surge models out there. Where does the modeling for this stand, and why do you guys use the Slosh model? But you know, there are other. If you watch Twitter, you see other people talking about storm surge models and so forth.
Yeah, I mean, storm surge models are no different than atmospheric models in the sense that they're trying to solve the physical equations of motion. In this case, the ocean versus the atmosphere. And then mathematically, ocean models and atmospheric models are kind of similar mathematically. It's just how you run them, and you know, there's just some differences on how you orchestrate it all. Slosh is one of several, just like atmospheric models, there's many atmospheric models. Slosh is one of many. But the reason Slosh is so good, there's two reasons. And, you know, I'm going to speak to the mechanics out there. If any of you sort of dabble on the weekends with an outboard engine, right? You know, so outboard engine, keeping it running. My outboard engine is pretty old, but if it breaks down on the water, I know precisely what to do to start it and get safely back to shore, because it's known, tested, embedded technology. There's nothing new on that engine. And Slosh is kind of the same. It's been so battle hardened over the years that it doesn't fail during a storm. And we know precisely what to do if it runs into problems. And you know, that's very reassuring for something that is of a high magnitude as what we do hit the Hurricane Center. But the second reason is more the scientific component. Some of these newer models are so advanced, and they consume so much computer power. They require so much computer power that you can really only run it one time, or maybe two times. And whereas Slosh, we can run it hundreds of times under different scenarios, meaning we can move the storm to the west or left. We can move the storm to the right or east. We can speed it up. We can slow it down. We can hit it with high tide. We can hit it with low tide. We can make the storm bigger, smaller, and we can, you know, just go through all these scenarios and then derive these really advanced risk-based products, right? And I'll give you an example of this. In Ida, you know, we were communicating with locals about whether or not levees could be compromised or overtopped. If you run one model one time, you can say, well, in that simulation, the levee didn't overtop, which is not particularly useful. What we were able to supply EMs and emergency managers during Ida was more sophisticated type decision support. We could say, you know, out of 600 of our simulations, you know, 200 are overtopping the levee system in your community. And that would imply, you know, like a 33% risk. So you can start giving people more advanced types of scenarios. The other things we can do is sort of say, well, if the storm moves this way, that's the scenario that's going to overtop. Right, that's the scenario. And then they can start keying in and starting to pay attention such that when the forecast evolves, they're kind of already perched and ready to execute. And so, you know, Slosh gives us all these abilities to do these more sophisticated type probabilistic, you know, scenarios, solutions, and is more reliable and steady than some of these other models.
Yeah, so somebody can notice, okay, ahead of time, if it stays to the right side of the cone, for example, then we're in bigger trouble than if it stays to the left side of the cone. You can give them that kind of information. And also what comes out of this is this concept of reasonable worst case, right? So that's the goal, is to tell people what's the reasonable worst case based on the best scientific knowledge we have here today. But you can do so much more also because computer power has just increased, right? I mean, that's right. A key part of this.
Right. I mean, we're in the process of switching within NOAA to a brand new supercomputer, which will afford us in storm surge basically three times the computer power that we had, you know, just a month or so ago. Mm-hmm. And with that, we can pursue new technologies, new physics. We can expand. For example, we're going to use that to expand our Slosh and probabilistic prediction system to the Central Pacific and provide guidance to Hawaii, places like Hawaii, which has historically never had, you know, storm surge predictions, at least real-time numerical modeling predictions. And we can expand and do some new things within Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands, which is, because we were talking waves earlier, the vast majority of the water rise there is due to wave physics and not traditional storm surge. Mm-hmm. Traditional storm surge really isn't a huge problem down there. It's all this wave setup, as we talked about before, which is the cumulative impact of water rise from waves over the course of time.
So that's because they have so much deep water offshore. Right.
Correct.
When you have deep water offshore, you get bigger waves. When you have shallow water offshore, you get more storm surge that pushes farther inland.
Exactly. You know, the deepest part of the Atlantic is right off the coast of Puerto Rico. So and then what happens when you have this deep shore or deep drop off is the waves break right at the immediate coastline. Mm-hmm. And so their energy is contained in a very narrow swath right at the energy of the breaking wave is right there at the coastline. And so the water piles up more. So we're able to employ a new version of Slosh that has these waves, this advanced wave physics in it. And that's what allows us to expand our guidance to Puerto Rico and Virgin Islands and then Hawaii, which similarly has a steep bathymetry.
Yes. Yeah. And that's why the storm surge on the east coast of Florida has bigger waves than the storm surge on the west coast of Florida because of the deeper water offshore. Hey, Brian here. I'll be back with Acting Director Jamie Rome from the National Hurricane Center after this quick break. All right, but it's true, isn't it, for all the computer models, this increased computer power really is in large measure responsible for our better forecast these days for every hazard in the hurricane. Do you think that, and forecasts from the Hurricane Center have gotten step-by-step better every year, or on an average, certainly, but do you think that people think today, because there's been so much success, generally if the Hurricane Center says a hurricane is coming, that people think that they're better than they are, that the forecasts are actually better than they are, they have too much confidence today? I mean, I remember back to Hurricane Andrew, and at that time, we didn't really think that you could forecast a hurricane 2 or 3 days out. So the fact that the forecast changed dramatically, you know, wasn't like a crazy idea. Oh, it changed dramatically. Oh, well, they always change dramatically because they can't be forecast. But my sense is people, you know, put too much, they look too much at the details of the forecast. I mean, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's a challenge. Improving hurricane accuracy is a double-edged sword. You know, on the one hand, there's the obvious benefit, an improved forecast, a more accurate forecast has massive societal benefits. But it also comes with this expectation that they're always going to be that accurate and that you can zoom in. I see these things on TV now where it makes me want to pull what's left of my hair out. Where people are zooming in on like the edge of the cone, and it's like my house is now out of the cone, or my house now is barely clipped by the hurricane force winds. And I mean, that's just insane from a scientific perspective, because the science, while it has rapidly improved, does not allow that type of fidelity or granularity. Yet there's a societal expectation that hurricane forecasts are perfect. And so we see these situations where we have a big storm. You can rattle off any of the past big storms where, you know, from a scientific perspective, the forecast was incredibly accurate from historical standards. But the public perception of that forecast often is not, and there's often a bit of a disappointment from the community in that the forecast didn't materialize as they thought it would.
Yeah, so let's talk about one of those. Hurricane Laura was an incredible example of sort of National Hurricane Center philosophy working, storm surge forecasting, and also the sensitivity of storm surge to the track. And also how the media message is affected by where the reporters concentrate themselves, right? So first of all, let's talk about the situation in metropolitan Houston, Harris County, Galveston County, and that area, especially while the European model was showing this very dangerous scenario. And if it were right, the Gulf water would have been pushed into Galveston Bay, and it would have been bad for metropolitan Houston, but no evacuation orders were issued because of the Hurricane Center forecast. And I know you just recently talked about this because I was at the conference with you. Talk about that, the thinking that went into not biting on that really dangerous looking Hurricane Center forecast and the philosophy behind making the call that the Hurricane Center did.
Well, I mean, this is a great example of why amateurs looking at models online can be incredibly dangerous. Because while there is this perception out there that the European model is always right, that's simply not true. It's a very good model, and we use it a lot here at the Hurricane Center. But we also know the strengths and limitations of that modeling system and what situations might lend it to have what's called a bias, meaning it skews one way or another. And so in this case, the European model in all of its ensembles, which ensembles are just the same model run many, many times, and the European model is run about 51 times, all of those 51 ensemble members were basically threatening Houston, Galveston. Mm-hmm. But we knew from experience that this particular setup, the European model tends to have a bit of a westward bias. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we had other data that we were looking at the time.
Too far left, in other words.
Yeah, too far left. Yeah. And so we had other information at the time that allowed us to lean more heavily on other modeling solutions and to apply, quote unquote, a correction, if you will. Mm-hmm. And that caused us to not bring the forecast, the official forecast, all the way over to Houston, Galveston. And then we were able to, we felt strongly enough in that forecast to, you know, working with the local officials, you know, encourage them to hold back on what would have been a massive evacuation. Because Houston, Galveston, you know, it's a couple million people at a minimum that's probably in harm's way in that type of a strike. And again, we're going back to Rita, you know, 104 people died in the evacuation alone. So you're really, really trying hard not to evacuate unnecessarily, because it just has a massive societal impact. It crushes the local economy in terms of taxes and revenue. It just puts a huge strain on society.
Yeah, although that is how we keep people safe that live in harm's way from storm surge, right? So I remember looking at that going, wow, this is a gutsy forecast here, but you know, you're weighing these two, both of them are really dangerous and terrible things. And I had to rank, somebody asked me to rank the worst hurricane cities. I put Houston as number one in that ranking because of the petrochemical complexes and all that. And if you get big storm surge, it pushes all that super polluted water up into the city and all of the other things. It is it's a very dangerous situation there. All right, so to talk about the other piece of Laura, which I know is near and dear to your heart, the Lake Charles, Cameron Parish situation in southwestern Louisiana, Lake Charles being the main city, but it's 30 miles from the Gulf, but it's connected to the Gulf by the Calcasieu Ship Channel, among other north-south waterways there, which is something of a funnel for storm surge. And that's where the media people were in Lake Charles, of course. All right, talk about how that played out.
Well, the Calcasieu Pass is basically a waterway or a highway for storm surge to very quickly and efficiently penetrate all the way to Lake Charles with nothing to stop it. There's no gates or anything like that to stop it. And if Laura would have moved just west of Calcasieu Pass, where the RMW or eyewall, or the strongest onshore push of winds, would have struck that pass, it would have put probably 15 feet of water up into Lake Charles. And that was a very, very plausible outcome. And we would have been negligent not to communicate that risk. Remember,
we're how much did it miss by? Was it 15 miles or something? Yeah. Is that the number that I remember
it
you saying?
By much. It ended up going inland just east, east of the pass. Mm-hmm. And so now you have winds kind of blowing more either shore parallel or shore offshore, mm-hmm. versus shoving the water right in the pass. And even with that configuration, they still got 9 feet right there, you know, at the pass. And so, you know, and the reaction afterwards was the more disappointing part, because, you know, for various reasons, the media had camped out up at Lake Charles, probably because it was just, you know, had access and, you know, things that media needed to cover the storm.
And besides that, you couldn't really be at the coast there. I mean, right. All the residents left. I mean, everybody left, right? Because it's like super dangerous place to be down there at the coast.
Yeah, and so when the sun came up, everybody saw the extreme wind damage that occurred over Lake Charles, but they didn't see any signs of water. So the narrative was that the storm surge just vanished. It just evaporated,
right.
Which, you know, you cannot push a Cat 4 anywhere in the Gulf of Mexico and not produce storm surge. I mean, that was just absurd that people thought the surge had vanished. And we started getting all these things like, oh, these theories of, you know, something absorbed the storm surge, or the storm wasn't strong for a long enough period of time to allow the surge to build up. And it had nothing to do with any of that.
Right. Or it was overstated was the really unfortunate statement,
right,
that really smart meteorologists made in some big rush that really was disappointing. And I know that was really disappointing to you as well.
Yeah, I mean, and if that happens, I think outside of the meteorological community, it's disappointing but understandable. It's our job as risk communicators to explain, you know, why that happened or why it occurred at a little bit east of where people thought. But when it happened within our own scientific community, it was really disheartening to see people who should know better falling prey to that particular narrative.
Well, I think it just reinforces what you said, that this understanding of how storm surge works is not well distributed even among, you know, savvy weather people. Right. It really is kind of a different thing. So then last year there was Ida, of course, which caused two widely separated disasters, one in southeastern Louisiana and the other in the northeast in New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and surrounding areas. So let's go in reverse order since we're talking about the dangers of water. Freshwater flooding has taken over as the number one killer on average in recent years, especially people in cars drowning because they drive into flooded areas or get swept away or something else terrible happens. Is there something to learn from that event in the Northeast in terms of terminology or messaging or alerting? And you know, I mean, I know there's something to learn because I saw it right in front of me happening. But, you know, what's your sense of what can be learned and what we need to learn?
I think this goes back to our original discussion about, you know, the purest definition of storm surge versus storm tide and the physical scientists wanting to keep things pure. There's a societal response upon hearing the phrase storm surge or storm surge warning. It sort of evokes this sense of you must do something, usually evacuate away from the coast. But when you hear the phrase flood warning, society doesn't yet, we haven't trained society yet to respond differently. I mean, what is the human response to a flood warning?
Besides that, we put up a flood warning for a small area that gets flooded or a big area that gets flooded, right? They both get the flood warning. So it does have a wide range of different kinds of impacts, scales of impacts, I should say.
I think we've got to try to move towards linking these flood products with a societal response. And whether that's training your outreach or whether that's evolution of the phrases we use for flood impacts to evoke that reaction is a social science, research opportunity. But right now, when people hear flood warning or flood watch or whatever, they just think it's going to rain a lot. It doesn't click inside their brain that there's an action that needs to be taken here, certainly not to the extent that when people hear a hurricane warning, right? You know, everybody in South Florida knows that when you hear a hurricane warning, it's time to shutter up, right? There's a societal reaction to that product that just isn't mimicked in a flood warning.
Yeah, and in the Ida case in the New York City general metropolitan area, it didn't even trigger emergency management people in New York City and the administration, the mayor and whatnot, to do special things to the public. Now, they did do special things kind of behind the scenes in terms of cleaning out drains and did things like that. But it didn't trigger what happens so often in New York City, which is the mayor gets on TV and said this is a dangerous thing. It didn't jog minds at that level, which kind of tells you that something needs to be done to be sure that happens. And I think the extreme case of this, which is such an interesting case, is earlier in June was the 50th anniversary of Hurricane Agnes, which was this devastating flood in the northeastern U.S., right? And it seems to me that this would be a massive messaging challenge today because people, that had a track, right? That had a track to follow. And the track was offshore from Virginia all the way to New York City. It essentially came ashore just east of New York City. But it was offshore. But yet the concentration of the flood was in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, was the bullseye, and all up there from Virginia up to inland in Pennsylvania. It seems like that would be a great tabletop exercise or something, and trying to imagine how that would work today and how you would message that, because I'm sure the forecast would probably be pretty good today, but how do you message that with the storm way over there, you know, don't look where the storm is, look over here, feels like that's what, you know, what you'd be up against.
Yeah, so I think you hit on a good point here is a lot of people have what I call cookbook meteorology, meaning, oh, if the storm goes here, I get that. If the storm is offshore, it's not that big of a deal. You know, they have all these sort of, you know, mental models in their head. And what happens in a case like, you know, Agnes, I assume it was interacting with the front.
Yeah, the weather was, it wasn't a front so much. It was an upper level disturbance. It was actually kind of a cutoff over that moved in over Pennsylvania. They had all this cold air aloft. So essentially it was a front, yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, in that case, you can get these rain shields that are, or heavy rain, if you will, that departs from these traditional mental models of how a hurricane works. You know, a lot of people, you know, look at the phrase dirty side of the storm, right? Dirty side of the storm, right side of the storm. That narrative presumes that the right side of the storm relative to its forward motion is always going to be the worst impact. And clearly it's not always the worst impacts.
Especially early in the year and late in the year, quite often it's the other side. It's the left side, as a matter of fact. Yeah. Because it interacts with upper air. Brian here. Let's take a quick break. We'll be back on the Fox Weather Tracking the Tropics podcast in just a moment. So what's new this hurricane season? Any new products, new models we should be looking for?
Yeah, so if you remember the experimental storm surge graphic that we launched last year, sort of denoted on a map, this 4 to 6 feet that we were talking about earlier with the monochromatic red, you know, line. We're going to colorize it this year. And that is to say, the colors used will be based off the severity of the storm surge. So you'll move from a cool color palette for the lower storm surges to a warm, so like oranges, reds, and purples for extreme storm surge. And this is based off how we noticed that the media was colorizing this graphic. And it's basically our effort to try to make this easier for our media partners to communicate. You know, if they're having to do it manually, then, you know, we want to try to automate that process for them to make it easier. So that'll be experimental this year for another season. If it's successful, then we'll make it operational and sort of codify it in future years. Now, behind the scenes, we're testing, so not available for public consumption, but behind the scenes, we're testing a next generation warning dissemination system. So this is more, I think, not models and forecasting, but more, compute IT type stuff and how we package up a warning and then we sort of ship it out the door and have it delivered to your phone or to your website. And we think early application of this new technology, we tested it in Ida, results in a rather substantial reduction in the warning area, meaning the size of the area that is placed under a storm surge warning. And if this were to be materialized and if we could field it, meaning operationalize it, it would also have a similar impact on evacuations, because evacuations are often tied to the storm surge warning area. And this would sort of further where we started this discussion, where we're basically trying to shrink the size of warnings and evacuations while not increasing mortality, at least direct mortality, with a storm. And that's why you've noticed the rather sudden, you know, we're tracking deaths more than we may have historically done, so that we can continue to measure ourselves to make sure we are in fact not negatively impacting mortality while we continue to refine and shrink the hurricane warning and make it more hopefully precise.
Yeah, so talking about shrinking, the cone shrunk a little bit this year, reflecting slightly lower errors in the track forecasts, although slightly bigger, a tiny bit bigger at 5 days. Do you think we're coming close to a limit on an accurate hurricane forecast can be, or is there something coming along you think that will, you know, kickstart another downward trend?
Yeah, so the cone's 20 years old this year. Who knew that? So happy 20th anniversary to the cone. And unlike humans, it has shrunk with age. Right. So it's getting skinnier as time marches on. But to your original question, we're probably quickly approaching the limits of what can be achieved with respect to track accuracy in the near term, in the 0 to 3 days. But I think there's a lot of potential work in the longer term track, say 4 or 5, and we're experimenting with day 6 and day 7 track forecast internally. But the bigger nut, or the more exciting, the nut to crack, or the more exciting thing is our advances in intensity forecasts, specifically these so-called rapid intensifiers. And these are basically storms that acquire a huge increase in wind speed over a very short period of time. They just strengthen very rapidly. And they have historically been very, very difficult. Andrew would be a great example.
All the Cat 5s, right? If any of those four Cat 5s that are in the record book were to hit again, they would all be difficult in that regard. They were all rapid.
And they've all historically done that very, very close to land, leaving society little time to react to the worst hurricanes out there. I mean, they all form and rapidly intensify really, really close to land, just like Andrew or just like Michael that hit the Florida Panhandle. And so, but increasingly, we've gotten better at anticipating and advertising the potential for these systems to rapidly intensify. And Ida last year was, a textbook example of we were able to forecast and advertise the potential for rapid intensification long before it happened.
Almost from the time it formed in the first place, which was really a change in the paradigm of how you communicate this possibility.
Right. And I mean, you had mentioned earlier gutsy forecast respect to Laura. Ida, the initial forecast from Ida basically showed the system going from basically nothing, a disturbance, to a near Cat 3. And I've worked at the Hurricane Center for 23 years, and I remember saying at the time, that's the most bold forecast I've ever seen in my time at the Hurricane Center. It was just absolutely shocking that we were able to produce that forecast and it largely materialized. In fact, it went beyond that. It went even stronger than that. Another example, we were talking about the narrative that happens after, after a storm. Some people claimed after Ida that there was no advance notice, but I mean, from a scientific perspective and looking at Cat 4s that have previously struck the U.S. coastline, I mean, that was an astronomically great forecast from a lead time perspective.
Well, because it told everybody that, wow, this is a real thing. This, we have this problem that in the Gulf, especially if you get something that forms kind of close in, oh, it's just a tropical storm. But right. The idea that out of the box to forecast a really significant hurricane, when people get used to that, I think that'll make a big difference.
I think you're right. I think people are just not used to us being able to convey that potential at those lead times. And so I think we just need a couple of seasons for people to work up that trust factor enough to react to it.
Yeah, I think that's right. So just going back to what you said about, I know internally you guys have been working on 6 to 7 day forecasts for, it's been a long time, I think, seems like. I mean, years fly by. Well, from my standpoint, that's a mixed bag because you already hear from lots of people that have, forecast fatigue, cone fatigue, right? We're in the cone so often because it's a 5-day cone where, back in the beginning, 20 years ago, it was a 3-day cone, which was kind of a preparation cone. And you can just imagine, now it doesn't mean that if you do a 7-day forecast, it has to be a cone that goes out 7 days. If it did, you could imagine, excessive cone fatigue would materialize from that. What's your thinking on the balance between making those longer term forecasts and how that might affect credibility, because more often they're going to be wrong at those longer lead times, and this kind of public fatigue factor and kind of being alerted in some fashion, you know, more often, even more often than they are now.
Yeah. I mean, especially the last 2 weeks, I've been thinking about this quite a bit because I abruptly inherited it. You know, it's a huge challenge and one that we don't take lightly, because if you extend the comb, if that's the solution to day six and day seven, you're going to end up doing damage to the cone or the public perception of the cone in the days when it's most critical that they have trust in the cone, because the errors at those longer lead times will be substantially higher than the errors at day three, four, and five. And so there's that aspect of it. And, you know, I don't know that one can simply extrapolate that the tool we use for days one through five is the tool that you would use for days six and seven. I mean, it could be that there's like a quote unquote outlook type product.
Risk area type product. Yeah.
Yeah. A risk area or something like that that would augment the cone and sort of help convey, you know, hey, a heads up, heads up to this portion of the, Gulf Coast or what have you, that, if you've got some preparations that need to take place, now's the time to do it. And, ideally, I wish people would make those preparations on June 1, but I'm a realist too, and recognize that people aren't always going to do that. And so some sort of conveyance of risk beyond day five probably does have a societal benefit, but how to convey it without doing irreparable damage to the cone remains. And to your point about, it seems like we've been working on it for a long time. It's just because, number one, it's a particularly difficult, project to work on. And we're also very, very cognizant of not doing damage to the existing products and services.
Yeah. When the cone first went to 5 days, there was this idea, okay, we're going to put crosshatch on days four and five, and somehow that's going to be different. But I mean, that went away in a big hurry in terms of the public perception, mostly, I think, because the media ignored that. Although I remember doing that way back in the beginning, but the media basically ignored the crosshatching of day four and five to somehow say that's a different cone than the day one through three cone.
The other thing that's contributing to the duration of the experimentation is the cone itself, I alluded to earlier, is 20 years old. It basically hasn't changed over the course of those 20 years. The cone itself is probably due for an evaluation and possibly not an overhaul, but possibly some sort of refinement and improvement. And I think we would try to the extent possible to do those things collectively. So it's the cone, however it evolves, would feed back on how one conveys uncertainty at days six and seven. So we're trying to do those two together. We've got some pretty good early social science that suggests that the cone itself doesn't need a dramatic overhaul, but probably does need some improvements on the edges, some sort of refinements, if you will. And we're working through those findings now.
Yeah, that whole project is very, very interesting. All right, Jamie, thanks so much. Congratulations on your job. I know it's going to be busy, and thanks for being on.
Thank you so much for having us. Give us opportunity to talk about hurricane season.
All right, take care. National Hurricane Center Acting Director Jamie Rome. So much of the Hurricane Center Director job is interfacing with the rest of government, FEMA, the Department of Defense, Department of State, and more. Jamie's already done a lot of that in his career, so he can step right in, which, of course, is great. And a tribute to the deep bench at the Hurricane Center, Dr. Cody Fritz has taken over the storm surge unit. Cody's very knowledgeable and experienced, so progress there will continue as well. Be sure you subscribe to our Tracking the Tropics podcast. Our next one will be after the July 4th holiday with another expert in the world of hurricanes and weather. So be ready for that. And remember to download the Fox Weather app. You can watch the live stream of Fox Weather on your phone or your iPad just by clicking in the upper right. And you can watch Fox Weather at foxweather.com or on the Roku channel, YouTube TV, and lots of other streaming platforms. So I'll see you there on Fox Weather on the stream, and follow me at Twitter at B Norcross or on Facebook and Instagram. Just Google it. You'll find me. It's easy. Until next week, I'm Brian Norcross. Be well and stay informed.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network. Subscribe and listen to the Trey Gowdy Podcast. Former federal prosecutor and four-term U.S. congressman from South Carolina brings you a one-of-a-kind podcast. Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.